All right, let me go. I got some text messages here. 37890, keyword Amos. Question on ADHD. Can someone have ADHD that only affects their schoolwork? In other words, if you have attention deficit disorder, is that just a schoolwork thing, or that's just going to be when you're at home playing with the Xbox?
I think with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder.
Don't you be taking all the. Let these people.
I was just going to say.
Come on, step up. See, they let the. They try to say, look, the psychiatrist.
Adults with ADHD and children, it doesn't just affect your schoolwork. It can affect you when you go home and you start projects.
So it's not just something that when you get off the school bus, it suddenly hits you.
No.
Okay.
No.
All right. Somebody else was talking about NAMI. And it says, Indiana received a D from NAMI on the delivery of mental health care and left me the link so I can look it up myself. Now, that's a smart person, a text message of 37890, keyword Amos. Another question, do the children born with addiction, do they become mentally ill later in life? So if somebody is born as a crack baby or born as a child to an alcoholic or someone addicted to prescription drugs, are they susceptible to mental illness?
Anyone is susceptible to mental illness, and there may be some increased risk, but it's far from true that just because an individual was born addicted to a certain substance that they were exposed to prior to birth, that they will go on to develop an addictive illness or any other type of mental disturbance later on in life. I remember in the 1990s, there was a lot of fear of crack babies. Mm-hmm. I remember there were whole nurseries full of so-called crack babies in some urban centers. And one of the main public health questions being posed at that time was, what would happen as these individuals got older and moved forward in their lives? Well, what happened is that in the ensuing decades, those individuals actually, in many cases, fared no worse on a number of measures than their peers who actually had not been exposed to crack cocaine. So even infants exposed to heroin, for example, before birth, can go on to have normal lives. Those born with fetal alcohol syndrome sometimes have some intellectual blunting or some cognitive delays, but that doesn't mean they can't have good quality of life.
On crime, is mental health issues disproportionate with people arrested or convicted of crime?
I think that's absolutely true. And one of your earlier listeners even spoke a little bit about prisons being a big part of where individuals in the community get mental health treatment. Mm-hmm. And a lot has been written about that. And in some respects, it's true. What you have, if you look at individuals who are incarcerated, is by and large those who have struggled for much of their lives. They struggle with addiction. They struggle with academic failure or academic underperformance. Right. Many individuals who are incarcerated all over the country are functionally illiterate, for example, have very limited educational background, limited job prospects, limited access to health care. And so before they come to jail or prison, they actually have not had good health care. They haven't seen a physician recently. They haven't actually had past traumas that they've been exposed to addressed. And so, unfortunately, part of what your earlier listener talked about actually has some basis in fact, in that in our jails and in our prisons, individuals are actually receiving probably the only mental health care that they're going to get if they don't request it once they're out.
239-1310. Back to the phones. And Tanya. Tanya, thanks for waiting.
Hi, Amos. Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
And I have some questions, but I also wanted to make some comments as well.
Okay.
But I do want to address one thing that was just recently said. The person had texted in and had asked about their child having attention deficit disorder. Is it only in school, or does it affect them when they play that Xbox? And I think that that should be expounded on just a little bit, simply because in school, attention deficit disorder is kind of a 50-50 thing sometimes. And I have three out of five children that suffer from attention deficit disorder. The oldest one is now 30. So if it's something that they like to do, they will automatically concentrate on. Where she would probably see it most at home is if she tells him to put something up or clean something up and they don't do it. And you're consistently having to remind them, get them back on task to do it. But I do want to say this. Back in 1995, the foremost leading authority on attention deficit disorder was located in Atlanta. And we were military and were stationed on a military post in Fort Benning, Georgia. But to make a long story short, one of the things that they had said was attention deficit disorder is caused by a protein deficiency. And what I don't hear every time I hear a parent call in or just speaking with anyone on the street, I don't hear anyone speaking about the child's diet and increasing their protein. The three children out of my five that I have, one is 30, one is 27, the other is 21, all of them control their attention deficit disorder through protein. They have a high protein diet, and they have done that since the early 90s. And this is how they function, because medication for them, they didn't like how it made them feel. They did not like the effects of it, so they control it through diet. Not all children can control it through diet, but it does help with the protein. And then I hear, and the few of the parents that I have met and I'm listening to, they, of course, they understand the medication. They understand what it does. But I want to say this. Most children that suffer from attention deficit disorder have a tendency to be geniuses. How many of these children have been tested for their IQ? And a lot of the misbehavior that they see in school is because
of the IQ. Yeah.
Yes.
No,
and
no.
So if no one recognizes that they have a higher IQ, a lot of that behavior would seem extreme, it would have seemed drastic, all of that. So how many of these children's IQ are being tested? And is that part of some of the services that this group and panel that you have that you're speaking to, how many of those services are offered through them to test the IQ?
You've raised a very good question, and others have raised this before, not necessarily in the context of mental health, but Dr. Dickens, when we talked earlier about particularly seniors, you know, and boredom and depression and things that could, you know, be a signal of mental health or not being, you know, not keeping your mind active in terms of older, could it be on the younger side? Somebody that is, you know, highly educated, not getting the kind of challenge they are, and then they get, you know, and then they get tempted, be a mental illness. So how important is testing to see not mental health testing, but cognitive testing, IQ and otherwise? Because there is a point, if somebody's highly intelligent and they're in an environment where they're easily bored, that could that cause some disorders?
You know, that's why it takes training and experience to become a confident and competent diagnostician. It sounds like if someone is academically gifted, if they are advanced, then some of the boredom that they're experiencing might be misinterpreted as ADHD. Midtown Mental Health Center's Children's Services does offer intelligence testing. Schools also offer intelligence testing. But I think that IQ testing can enlighten us as to an individual child's difficulty with some mental health disorders, but sometimes ADD requires other types of treatments too. And it is true, I think, that some have responded to various types of dietary modification, but that doesn't work for everybody. And so we do end up using psychostimulants in some cases with these children. In some, they don't require medications at all, as I mentioned earlier, modifying their external circumstances or having a behavioral plan in place, educating teachers about how to be more sensitive to the different learning styles of these children can also be of help. So again, what we stress is a more holistic approach. We're not focusing wholly on medications or therapy per se, but what is it that this particular child is going to respond best to? So if you find that you respond well to dietary modification, of course, we're going to support that.
All right. Tomorrow, in our first hour, the folks from Concerned Clergy will be here. In our second hour, the head of the Indiana State Teachers Association, Teresa Meredith, will be here on Wednesday. Somebody from the HHS, from the Affordable Care Act, will be here. We'll also talk about a report that was issued today by the Indianapolis Chamber and IPS, ways IPS can save money, make money. There's some controversial things, including let some of the kids ride the Indigo buses instead of the yellow school bus. We're talking about high school kids. Now, that may be the most radical thing in the whole report. That'll cause some problem. Anyway, we'll talk all that and more upcoming this week. It's After News with Amos after these. The folks from Eskenazi always love hearing the voice of Eskenazi. In the house from Eskenazi Health Midtown Community Mental Health Center, Margie Payne, Dr. Gene Dixons, Rebecca Bricker, Allison White, Gene Ford, Erica Anderson, and Kelly Rounds. Gene Ford, you deal with addiction, and I think people in the community, we remember back in the day when hair was big and bell bottoms were wide and the shoes were high. We remember heroin, and we thought it was gone. It's back. And with the vengeance, you're seeing a lot of that now in your addiction work?
Yes. We see heroin being back. For one, it's a cheaper drug.
Cheap.
It's a cheaper drug.
Oh, Lord. And they're using the needles?
They're using the needles, and they're also snorting it. With our patients that come in, they're even younger, from 18 and up, but this is what we're getting.
Does being addicted to that drug cause you to do real stupid things like PCP back in the day? Is it that crazy?
Addiction can make you obviously make bad choices. Mm-hmm. Now, I work in the narcotics treatment program, which is a methadone maintenance program.
Right.
Whereas methadone that we give our clients is a long-acting synthetic opiate, which prevents them from using other opiates by controlling the cravings and withdrawal symptoms.
You know, some people used to say that methadone caused an addiction. I know you've been around doing this almost two decades. You remember hearing that?
Yeah. Yeah. Methadone, our plan of disengagement with methadone maintenance is to slowly detox off of methadone, medically supervised detoxification.
Okay.
The rule of thumb is the slower, the better.
Mm-hmm.
If a patient has been active in their addiction for, say, 10 years, you might want to think about your recovery a little longer, being active in that, because recovery is a change of behavior. When you're active in your addiction, you have almost perfected that behavior. So now you're in recovery, you need to start changing your behavior.
Is any addiction not treatable?
good question. I think addictions can be treatable depending on how they identify where they need to go to have it treated. I mean,
can faith play a role in changing someone off their addiction?
Faith doesn't hurt. It's always good to pray.
Mm-hmm.
But with the disease of addiction, you need a little bit more help in the way of services provided through our program, Methadone Maintenance Program.
Prayer helps, Jesus helps, but, you know, you need the stuff and family and friends.
Oh, absolutely.
All of that's got to work. So is it harder for somebody who's all alone that to get off an addiction? In other words, a patient you have and it's just them. Maybe it's one of the homeless that we have on our streets. Maybe it's somebody that the family has abandoned them or they abandoned their family.
I would say yes, and that's why it's important to develop as many support systems as you can. With our program, we have support groups to help them develop good coping skills in high-risk situations. Mm-hmm. We encourage them to go to those support groups. But as many people that can be a positive support to you, you should use.
Let me go back to the phones. And Anonymous, you've been waiting patiently. Thank you for waiting at 239-1310. Hi there.
Hi, Amos. How's the panel doing, too? I was just calling to find out something because my son was diagnosed in school, and he had an IEP, and they were saying that he was mildly mentally handicapped. Well, they also told me that he may not be college material, that thinking about maybe going to a two-year college or, you know, because a four-year college wouldn't be suitable for him. I guess what I want to find out is how accurate is this, because as I speak now, my son goes to IUPUI, and he will be a senior next year. And so I guess what I'm trying to find out, how accurate are these tests that they're doing in school?
Who told you that your kid couldn't be successful?
I'm telling you, and this wasn't an IPS school. This was a township school.
This was the school telling you, not a medical professional.
This was a therapist that told me this because they said he was mildly mentally handicapped, that he needed to think about maybe going to a two-year instead of a four-year.
Because, and this was the therapist working for the school, not a therapist.
Yes.
Since I got medical professionals here, somebody that has an addiction or somebody that has a mental illness, can they overcome the illness, maybe not fully overcome the illness, fully get well, but can they excel in a profession? Can they excel in school even though they may have a disorder or they may be trying to recover off an addiction?
Of course.
Our clients are people with diagnoses that present with symptoms of the diagnosis versus the diagnosis being who they are. Mm-hmm. So a kid that has attention issues is a kid that may need to play with a ball in his hand while he's doing his homework. It may be a kid that is more verbal versus doing written responses to things. You kind of have to take the symptoms and tweak them to fit the individual person, because symptoms are just that. They're a symptom of something. The greater part of that individual is the person themselves. So how it manifests in that person, a symptom will look different.
And caller, I'm not calling you out or anything. I want to make a statement for everybody that's listening that's involved in an IEP. The parent drives the goal of the IEP. Everybody listening within the sound of my voice, if you got a kid on an IEP in school and your goal is for that kid to graduate high school with a Core 40 diploma, that's what you put on the IEP, and the school either signs off on that or you sue the school. The parent drives the IEP, not the school. I want you to present. So if a school ever tells you your kid cannot do X, you tell the school, no, the goal is hit X. Now, how are we going to do that? No, the school was wrong, which goes back to what I said the first hour about educating these schools on what a kid can and cannot do. I appreciate that. Thank you, caller. 239-1310. Don't get me started on IEPs. 239-1310. We go to another anonymous. Hi there.
Hi, I got two questions.
Yes,
one of
sir.
Them is, what is a certified recovery specialist?
That's a great question. What is a certified recovery specialist?
In English.
Well, a licensed addiction counselor is probably a better term for it. You have to get certification from ACADA.
That's a national organization?
Uh-huh.
And you got a state license, too, that says state of Indiana?
Absolutely. You get mm-hmm. that from the IMPLA.
Okay.
But that's really what it's – you're asking – it's the same thing, basically.
But it's a it's a specialized thing.
Mm-hmm.
You just can't walk in off the street and say, hey, I can work with people, I can do this.
There's that type that Gene talked about. There's also another type, a certified recovery specialist that is a peer mentor that goes through education and training to help their peers who suffer from a mental illness or addiction.
So that's somebody been there, done that.
Right.
And I'm trying to, I've been where you've been.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
And I can be your peer. I can be your support person to help you through this.
Okay. Anonymous, sound like you had a second question?
Another question.
Yeah.
Would Essanazi or any other company be willing to hire a certified recovery specialist that has a learning disability in spelling?
All right, so if somebody had the qualifications to be a certified recovery specialist, but their spelling wasn't good, does that knock you out of the box?
Not necessarily, but they do have to document in the patient's record, and we need to be able to have legible writing and spelling and all that to be able to understand it and to interpret it.
So if somebody's out there listening and has the experience, but the spelling, maybe take a spelling test or something.
Absolutely.
Brush up on your spelling.
Absolutely. And
because you don't have the computers that automatically spell check the records?
Well, sometimes.
Because, you know,
do.
Folks, we done got spoiled in the world today.
That is so true. But that spell check does not catch everything.
that's exactly where I'm at right now. I have the qualifications to be a certified recovery specialist. And I have volunteered to be a certified recovery specialist through Eskenazi, and I am good at it. But when it comes down to writing reports, I just can't do that part of the job.
So you're not good on the writing side.
Exactly.
You can do the oral reports.
But no problem.
Have you applied?
No, I've only actually has been doing some volunteer work.
You've not gone through the application process?
No, because I can't even get past the application process.
What do you mean you can't get past it? You fill it out online. You can't get that far?
No, I really can't. When it comes down to being a certified recovery specialist, what I found was so remarkable about taking the certified recovery specialist test is that it doesn't require me to spell anything. It just required me to do a lot of reading and answering of questions, which is that's not part of my disability at all.
I can read, and
I can ask questions, but I can't spell. It's like a brick wall when it comes to me spelling.
Let me ask a question. You got a resume that you had somebody put together for you?
Yes, I do.
You have that. All right, I tell you what I'm going to do. I would like you to leave Chris your name and a number where you can be reached during the day. Someone will reach out to you to have you submit your resume and application. And we they make no promises, but seem to me if you know the work, they can teach. Somebody can teach spelling. There's probably some middle schoolers who could do some extra credit helping you spell.
I'm being serious about it.
You know, that could be a patient that maybe part of their treatment is, how do you help others? Working together. So hold on and give Chris that information, okay?
No problem.
All right, 239-1310, 239-1310. Let me go to Doris right quick, then we'll take a break. Hi, Doris.
Hi, Amos.
How are you?
Thank you for bringing this program to us.
You're welcome.
I'd like to give you some names of psychiatrists, black psychiatrists.
Okay.
There was Dr. Ocean Token at Midtown. I think he's in private practice now.
Okay.
Excellent. Dr. Diane Martin. Excellent. Even Dr. Deborah Carter, Dr. Blewett Carter, Deborah.
Yeah.
She's an excellent doctor for all of your health, and she will get you a psychiatrist.
Okay.
I want to say hello to Miss Payne. If you really have a problem, you can always go to Margie Payne. I know I've had to cancel because of the weather, but I taught a NAMI class and three times, and the NAMI people are very important for mental health. They have it for children, too, but I took the adult class and taught. And I just want to tell you, the head of Midtown now, the doctor, excellent. And we need to know more about mental health, but we need to get into programs, and we don't have many programs. But the churches could get into it if they would and hold NAMI classes, because that's where I took the lesson at Mount Olive Baptist Church, and then I went out and taught. But we need younger people now. So thank you, and thank you, Margie Payne. I'll still be making my appointment.
Oh, great, because you're going to come in and help us out, aren't you, and teach some NAMI classes.
I told you.
All right, thank you.
All right.
I appreciate it. 239-1310. 239-1310's Afternoons with Amos. We'll take a break. We'll be back with our remaining moments. It's Afternoons with Amos on a very busy Monday. Hey, let me go to another anonymous right quick at 239-1310. Hi there. You got about a minute.
Yes, I want to ask a question for your panel.
Mm-hmm.
I know a person, a mother, they keep on relapsing, and she's on one of your little methadone classes, but she knows how to play the system. Should she have custody of her children? Can I take my answer off there? Thank you.
All right. If somebody is relapsing and they're in addiction, can that affect their ability to keep their kids?
If they're relapsing and they're in methadone maintenance treatment, it would all depend on the urine drug screens, if they're positive, their participation in the program itself through the way of support groups. We can't divulge any information because of HIPAA regulations.
Even to DCS?
We cannot. And
Kelly's nodding his head. Even to DCS, you can't?
Well, if they sign a release.
Okay.
But.
An addiction. All right, come on. Kelly?
If we had reason to believe that the children were in harm, we would always contact DCS and report that we are all mandated reporters of the state and would protect the children first. Now, we would not make the decision whether or not they are fit to parent their children.
Right.
Now, in children's services, we would maybe work with DCS to do family work in the home in order to keep kids in the home. But that would ultimately be a decision DCS would make.
Let me go back to Romeo at 239-1310. Romeo, you got about a minute.
Okay, thank you for taking my question.
You're
my
welcome.
Question to the panel is, I'm trying to figure out if I'm being harmful to my son. He has attention deficit disorder, and that's what he's classified with. But when he's around me, he doesn't act crazy. He doesn't act like he has ADD. He minds me and he listens to what I say. His grades are good. But when he's around his mother, he has to take the medicine. And I guess what I'm asking is, when I was young, I did the same things he did, but I wasn't classified with ADD. Am I affecting him or harming him if I don't administer this medicine to him?
I think probably a reasonable response is that I'm glad to hear that you're concerned about your child. I think that adults would be more able to address your son's issues than the child would be to address them himself. I don't know if it's possible for you to have an open and honest dialogue with the child's mother about what you observe, about the changes in his behavior depending on who's around him at the time and whether or not he actually is administered medicines. But if you find that your child seems to be reasonably well adjusted without medicines and then in a different type of environment, the opposite is true. I wonder what role the medicines play. Probably, ideally, you and the child's mother would contact a healthcare provider, pediatrician, primary care provider of some other type, psychiatrist, and try to get at some of these answers a little at a time. time. Yep. I'm glad, though, that at least you are noticing that your child's behavior is not uniform and does tend to be influenced by environmental factors. As I mentioned, I think that's very important.
Romeo, how long has he been on medication?
He's been on medication for about, he's 15 now. I want to say he started when he was 7. But my concern is when he's around me, when he's living with me for the summer, he is, his summer school, grades, wrestling, everything is on point. When he's with his mother, she's convinced from doctors at the school that he needs to take medicine, that he needs to focus.
And it's
same behaviors in him that I did when I was his age.
It sounds like perhaps family counseling, even though, you know, this is a not a unitary family. I mean, no disrespect to you or the mom or to the kid. The other thing is, if you have confidence in the physician that diagnosed the medicine way back when, maybe it's also time for a family conversation, all the parents there, because he's getting close to college, to simply see, gee, what would happen if when he's with you in the summer or with you on spring break, he's not on the medication, to see if things stay copacetic. That's kind of like a scientific experiment. Okay, if he's not on, if he's cool when he's with the medicine, what happens if he's cool if he's without the medicine? But I think that needs to be in consultation not only with the medical doctor, but also probably with a psychologist or one of them to be able to help. So check your insurances. To see what's covered in mental health for the kid. And take advantage of those. But it sounds like you're a dad who's kind of seen that. How's his regular grades in school? Regular time.
He's a BC student when he's with his mother.
Okay.
He lived with me for 2 years, and he was a straight A student. At the age of 9 and 10, I was teaching him his numbers in French. He just, I don't know. I'm not disrespecting his mother, saying that she's not applying herself. I'm just saying that I don't see where the medication is necessary. But a doctor told her that I was harming him if I didn't administer the medicine to him.
You know, it sounds, and I'm just an honorary lawyer. I'm not even an honorary doctor. But it just sounds, medical doctor, but it sounds to me like he's bonding. He's doing male bonding, which is a good thing, you know, because they say if the boy's with his dad, that helps. And but I see something there, and the medical professionals that are here, they see something there. So see a professional, you know, check your insurance, you know, go to the hospital. And if your insurance says Eskenazi, I'm sure the folks at Eskenazi Midtown Community Health would love to see that whole family together. Thank you guys very much. Margie Payne, the CEO of Eskenazi Health, and Dr. Gene Dickens, world's greatest black psychiatrist that at least we've met. Rebecca Bricker, Allison White, Gene Ford, Erica Anderson. And Kelly Rounds didn't say much, but it was significant what he said. Guys, thanks very much for being with us.